The Health and Human Service Reform Committee will come to order. We do have a quorum. Representative Peterson moves the minutes from Tuesday, March 14, 2017. Are there any additions, corrections, or changes to be made to the minutes? Seeing none, all those in favor of the minutes from Tuesday, March 14, 2017, signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed, same sign. The minutes are approved for Tuesday, March 14, 2017. Representative Peterson then moves that the minutes be approved from Wednesday, March 15th, 2017. Are there any additions, corrections, or changes to be made to the minutes for Wednesday, March 15th, 2017? Seeing none, all those in favor of the minutes signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed, same sign. The minutes from Wednesday, March 15th, 2017 are adopted. First up today, we have House File 1331, Representative Zerwas. That will move that House File 1331 be referred to the General Register. We have the bill in front of us, Representative Zerwas. To your bill.
Oh, good morning, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members, House File 1331 looks at mental health screening data collected by a sheriff's office or a local corrections agency. This was brought to me by Dakota County and MICA. Under existing law, sheriff's office jail intake procedure is required to conduct a mental health screening to identify people who may have a mental illness. This bill allows the names of inmates identified as potentially having a mental illness be shared with local social service mental health authorities. It also allows the jail to refer an inmate upon discharge to county personnel in the welfare system to assist with coordinating access to services, including applying for MA, obtaining a photo ID, obtaining necessary prescription drugs, obtaining appropriate counseling with a mental health provider, and it also provides for the continued protection of the Tennyson notice and consent rights provided by HIPAA, the Minnesota Health Records Act, and other existing state and federal data privacy regulations. Sharing limited amounts of data on who may have a mental health illness or concern based upon evidence-based collection threshold score from a mental health screening tool with a local social services and mental health authority will help ensure that justice-involved individuals have early access to coordinated mental health services while in jail and upon discharge. This is important because early access to coordinated mental health services produces improved health and well-being outcomes for individuals and improved outcomes for the community, including a reduction in recidivism. The provisions related to the referral to the welfare system upon discharge are almost identical to the language for referrals under existing law for inmates having serious and persistent mental illness. The added language will provide for early access to coordinated services for individuals that may need services, but their mental illness does not yet rise to the definition of serious and persistent mental illness. With me today is Stephanie Radke, the Deputy Director of Community Services for Dakota County, to do a brief walkthrough of the bill.
Welcome to the committee, Ms. Radke. If you could please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Stephanie Radke. I serve as Deputy Director for the Community Services Division for Dakota County, and I appreciate the opportunity to testify in support of this bill. A lot of research has taken place in the last few years about the prevalence of mental health within our corrections and justice systems, mental health concerns. And we know in Dakota County alone, 25% of our inmates who are coming in through the booking process self-report a mental health concern, and many more are indicated as having a mental health issue through various screening processes. We know that folks coming into the jails, and this is not only within Dakota County and Minnesota, but there's a lot of research and good work happening on this issue nationally. But a lot of folks with mental health issues are coming in through our local county jails and the correction system, often because law enforcement does not have other options and do not know, other appropriate places and options to either deal with the immediate mental health issue, or the mental health issue may be a contributing factor to criminal behavior. But we do know going forward that having a mental health issue that is not appropriately and early addressed as the health issue is a factor leading to greater recidivism in folks coming back through our system without the appropriate treatment of that underlying health issue. So there's a lot of opportunities and a lot of great work that, again, is happening nationally and here in Minnesota. I know Dakota County as well as Hennepin County are doing a lot of collaborative work with our local corrections and judicial systems for how can we do a better job of coordinating and early identification of these mental health concerns, providing appropriate outreach and appropriate services to folks if they indeed wanted and agreed to it. But how can we move this work upstream and provide that appropriate health services earlier? So this bill really supports those, I think, innovative efforts to be more preventative in our approach in working with folks with mental health issues. It provides for the jails, as Representative Zerwas shared, sharing very limited information with the local county mental health authority if a mental health concern is present upon intake and booking, either through self-reporting or the jail using an appropriate established screening tool. The information passed on to the local mental health authority would not be that actual assessment of the mental health condition, but just whether or not that there's a mental health concern. So we would not get any deep medical information, you know, health records or anything like that, but just whether or not that mental health issue may be present. In addition to that, it does allow for the jail staff to be more proactive in directly referring, under limited circumstances, these individuals to county social services if they think there's a need for access to health insurance, other behavioral health care coordination, but to be more proactive in those referrals. Right now we have language and statute that allows for those referral mechanisms if an individual has severe and persistent mental health illness. But the goal here, I think the operative words are early outreach and access to service and coordinated services. So what this bill does is not wait until someone's presenting with very severe mental health issues, but try to coordinate and facilitate access to those services early on, as soon as we think a mental health issue may be contributing to a person's incarceration and interaction with the justice system. So we think this is a very positive language that really is supporting some of our innovative and coordination efforts with our local justice and correction systems. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Radke, for your testimony this morning. Representative Liebling.
Thank you. Good morning. Ms. Radke, I appreciate the intent of this bill. I think it's very laudable that you're trying to do this and thinking about this, and I think it's a concern that we all share about, you know, how to identify people with mental health concerns and get them the help that they need. I think we're all about that. But I have a more technical question about the bill, and that is the use of the term the welfare system or the phrase the welfare system. In here it's on line 1.17. The jail may refer an offender to county personnel of the welfare system. And I think it was Representative Zerwas said this is language modeled after another section of law, but I'm just wondering if that's a defined term someplace in law, because it seems more like the vernacular. I don't know if you can answer that or maybe staff can answer that.
Ms. Radke.
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling. Right now, the term welfare system is defined in sections 13.46, and it does include county social services as well as employment and economic support services. And I would need to pull up that language to see what else. But there's a definition in law for what that means.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Zerwas.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, if you read after the welfare system, it says, as defined in section 13.46, subdivision 1, paragraph C. So it's defined.
Representative Lewin.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I just wasn't sure if that was the term the welfare system or what that was modifying here. So it is a broader term that includes other things than health, I take it. You said it includes some job services and other things. So anyway, that's something to think about who the information might be going to. The other thing that I really am a little bit concerned about this is that, and I know, I see that it went to civil law, and I'm really surprised, frankly, that civil law didn't ask about this, that what you're doing here is sharing a very private issue without permission, without consent of the person. And I'm just wondering why we're doing this rather than, I think it would be great to have the jail ask the person, you know, it seems like you have a mental health concern. Can we get you, can we share your name and get you information or get you, refer you? I don't know why we're doing this without consent, but it seems actually a little extreme to me because you're saying that the names may be shared. And then although I heard Ms. Radke say we're only going to share certain very limited information, what it says here, what says the names, it says, in order to arrange for services upon discharge and may share private data as necessary to carry out the following. So I'm not really comforted that the information is limited, and even if it is just the name, you know, if I had a car accident and they took me to jail and it appeared that I was disoriented or depressed or something, suddenly my name is being shared with the county welfare system as somebody who might need services without my consent. That's how I'm reading this. And I understand it's for really good purpose and really well-intended, but I'm very uncomfortable with this unless you can give me more comfort about that issue.
Ms. Radke.
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, one of the challenges we face, and I appreciate your concerns, and we've talked about this very issue as well, is the really transient nature of folks who are coming through and cycling through our jails. And so often we have, you know, someone may be in custody only 24, 48 hours, and depending on their state and coming into that booking and intake, having that, they may not even be in a state of mind to give that sort of informed consent. And then if they have a release, then we've lost that opportunity for that coordination of services. And so the goal is to have at least an awareness of who's coming through with that, who may be presenting with the mental health a concern, so we can, working with the jail and the correction system, provide appropriate outreach. And then people will always have the, if we provide referrals and access to these services, people we serve will have the opportunity to provide, have the opportunity as always to provide consent to services. It really is that outreach and that awareness of there's other services here available. If you'd like some help providing, following up and receiving health care, access to health care, mental health services, people will always have that ability to provide that consent for the actual services.
Representative Whitley.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not really comforted by that. Okay. You know, you don't even know if the person already is seeing somebody when you're sharing their name. And, you know, the fact that it's, I mean, there could be language in here that says, you know, that consent will be requested, and that in an extreme situation when you have reason to believe that the person, you know, it doesn't have to be as extreme as severe and persistent mental illness perhaps, but this is pretty, this is opening the door pretty wide, and I guess I would just ask that this be really worked on a little bit more. I don't think this is ready for prime time. I think it's very concerning. You know, because we all, and again, I realize this is completely well-intentioned, and I'm really glad you're thinking about this and working on it. I just think that it's, you know, to just to refer people for possibly having a mental illness to give their name to somebody when without any consent by the person, just because they happen to be in the jail, I think is just a bridge too far. Thank
Representative
you.
Representative Zerwas.
Well, Mr. Chairman, members, Representative Liebling, This bill was heard in civil law. There was a robust discussion around the intake screening tool, how that information is used, and the challenges with individuals suffering with mental illness that are frequent occupants of our jail. And I think I'll bring the committee back to Representative Constantine said, I think it was in Health and Human Services Finance, is the greatest concentration in the United States of America of Americans with mental illness is the Cook County Jail. The second highest concentration of people with mental illness in the United States of America is the L.A. County Jail. So we know where people are that are suffering from mental illness, and we know that if we can connect them to services, we can treat them, and we can help them, and we can get them to the resources that will improve their life. Now, this bill was heard in civil law. It was vetted in civil law by that committee, the committee we asked to vet these issues, and it passed out of civil law with not a single dissenting vote.
Representative Wheatley.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Zulas, you know, I appreciate your interest in this. And the fact that it went through civil law, I mean, I don't know, sometimes we don't catch everything we should in committees. You know, I'll mention it to Representative Scott. I know she's, you know, tries to be a watchdog on these issues. But, really what you're doing is asking a person to give up their right to privacy because they're in a jail, because they're in a place where there's a high concentration of people who might have need. And because a person has need, even if they have need, is not a reason to give their name over to the county welfare system without their consent. It just isn't. I mean, there might be situations that really warrant that. I don't even frankly know if, you know, I mean, I could even imagine that this might incur a law challenge, a court challenge at some point. You know, I just really think it's not very tailored. And just to say that every person who goes into a jail who is then somebody thinks they might have a mental illness, can you can just give their name over to the county welfare system, even however well-intentioned that is. We don't need to debate it anymore. Yeah. I'm going to vote no on the bill. I hope you'll continue to work on it. Because it, as people sort of think about this more, I think it may raise a few red flags, but I think it could be fixed.
Response by Representative Zerwatz.
Well, to be clear, it's not if someone from the jail thinks that someone might have a mental illness. It's if they screen positive in the mental illness screening assessment that every jail by statute is required to implement upon intake of an inmate. It's not a jail employee's hunch. It's not a guess. It's not, I think so. This person has a look. It's they're screening positive on a mental health screening tool that we, as the state, have mandated that they use for every jail across the state of Minnesota. So I think that's really important. Another thing I would remind the committee of is that NAMI supports the bill. NAMI does not share Representative Liebling's concerns. And so I think that would be helpful for the committee to know as well.
Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It never ceases to amaze me that a bill will come forward, and I'll think to myself, we're not doing that already? Knowing that the procedure is screening, and it's through the state legislature, we allowed that to happen. What is the process now that it's not happening? I mean, we know and recognize we have a huge mental health crises in our state and throughout our nation. It just surprises me when I read your bill, Representative Zerwas, that aren't we doing this already? When the sheriff is intaking an inmate or a prisoner now inmate, you switch it to, through the screening process, they're not sharing that data once the inmate is released? Well, what's the procedure now?
Ms. Bradke.
I can answer.
Representative Zerwas.
Yeah, no, excellent question. The screening tool is predominantly used for classification of an individual as they come into jail to make sure they're in the appropriate housing. If someone's in crisis and needs to be not booked into a jail cell but taken to a hospital, if someone needs to have 24-hour supervision because during intake they're saying they might hurt themselves or someone else. And to be clear, and you brought up a great point, if the screening tool and the inmate does have indicate that they do have a serious and persistent mental illness, in law, we already do this. This is just saying that people that screen positive on the screening tool, but not the serious and persistent mental illness designation, that we do it. And so it's just opening it up, the system that we already do in current law.
Representative McDonald.
So then, thank you, Representative Zuros, Mr. Chair. So when an inmate is released and tested positive in that screening, currently, do the authorities, does the officer of the law have an authority to notify the Department of the Human Services?
Not if they're not serious. If the designation is not a serious and persistent mental illness, no.
Representative McDonald.
Very good. Well, then this is very important because there are instances where things are very serious and there's things that are half serious, if you will. And in this crisis with mental health, we need to be sure and give the jails and the correction officers the opportunity to have this tool to be able to do that, to share that data so that that person can get help. So I think it's a very good bill, and I support it.
Representative Moran.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Zuros, is this a statewide initiative?
Representative Zuros.
Mr. Chair, Representative Moran, it's changed state statute.
Representative Moran.
Okay. That's good. I was just concerned that maybe it was just being carved out for a certain county, but it's good to know it is a statewide initiative. And, part of me has some concern, as Representative Reading has, because I know that this summer I was had the opportunity to work with a young man who was struggling with mental illness and who, really had distrust of government and people interfering. And I know we also have statutes, laws on the books that says that we cannot force someone with mental illness to take their medication and to do other things. So my hope is that, we're not just doing things for people, we're doing it with them, and that we are giving them the opportunity to make some choices that they think may be best for themselves. I think that is really, really important. But we do know this is something that happens. We have many people who are currently incarcerated who should be in a facility, getting those needs provided for them. So my hope is that, as we are offering these services, that we are finding ways to include that person in the process, because otherwise they get very defensive.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Representative Ross?
Mr. Chair, Representative Moran, I completely agree. The bill would have the ability for the county to reach out and offer services for people that might be struggling with mental illness, that might not have insurance coverage, that might not be enrolled in MA or Minnesota Care, help enroll those individuals. If they are already being seen by a physician, but they don't have prescription drugs, it calls for in the bill the county to reach out and work with that and help folks connect people with prescription drugs. And so I think that's the goal of the bill, is to provide opportunities for the individuals to get the support.
Representative Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for sharing about NAMI. That was helpful. So to the point, actually, that Representative Moran brought up and you just shared, so how come it wasn't written with a piece that there would be consent to give the information out? So that I get that there's a decision point if they accept services. How come there wasn't a decision point? I know they are notified about the screening. There's consent around the screening piece that happens, but how come there wasn't? This wasn't written in a way that the person would have the ability to say, yes, you can release my information to social services, or no.
Representative Zuros. Ms. Radke.
Mr. Chair, Representative Olson, to my comments earlier, depending on the state of an individual coming into the correction system and law enforcement, they may not be able to provide informed consent, and depending on the situation of what's happening at that particular moment, I mean, sometimes people are placed on holds for less than 48 hours or 24 hours. Sometimes people are brought into the system, into corrections, as I noted earlier, because local law enforcement doesn't even know where else to or may not have another option for that individual. And so the intent was, and then with that happening, many people can fall through the cracks if we're relying on that consent very early on. This is just an awareness piece for that initial sharing of something is happening here with this individual. How can we rally around this individual, bringing the social services component much earlier into the process in a coordinated fashion? But to, I think, some of the earlier questions, this isn't about providing any kind of like forcing of services. It really is about that awareness and education of here's some opportunities, as well as that coordination of services if that person is already receiving services. Is there opportunities to improve outcomes by augmenting? But it's always in that person's control to accept services or not.
Representative Olson.
Right. And with a severe and persistent diagnosis already, that automatically happens. So if we're saying that that the screening here may show that the person isn't have a severe and persistent diagnosis or screening, I should say, my understanding would be they may have more of a cognitive capacity to decide, yes, I want my information released, or no. So I guess my question is still around, that seems like a decision point. And I get the timeliness and the ability to accept services, but I guess I'm just kind of feeling like that's a little bit of a squishy area and just wondering why that wasn't made a little clearer as a decision point to still allow that person. So if I know I'm kind of drilling down there, but I think that really hinges on, I would want to be able to have a voice in that if I was someone, and I imagine all of us, where we have decision and autonomy to exercise that, regardless of a mental health screening or not, it just seems a little squishy, and want to wonder why it was kind of left that way to not allow the person to be able to make that choice to give out their information.
Exactly.
Mr. Chair, Representative Olson, the language was designed to provide maximum flexibility for coordination, recognizing that depending on circumstances that when we do have folks with mental illness who are entering our correction system, it presents in a variety of ways, in many unpredictable ways. And so it was really about that kind of maximum coordination and how do we try to, as much as possible, move that coordination early in the process. One of the reasons that NAMI has supported this bill is because we know that early access to services is really instrumental in outcomes for people with mental illness, and if we don't do a better job of providing that earlier access, that's when, it's different for every individual, but that's when things can really escalate to become that serious and persistent mental illness. So it really was about more embedding together social services with our local corrections agencies and having that flexibility as much as possible to do that early outreach and coordination.
Representative Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's good. Thank you.
Representative Liebling.
So going back, thank you, Mr. Chair. Going back to some comments, Representative Zerwas, you made a big point about this isn't just somebody who thinks they may have a mental illness. This is a screening tool. Well, if you look at the language of the bill, it says names of people who are screened positive or may have a mental illness. Screened or may have a mental illness. So I don't know what the may have a mental illness is. It's obviously not the same as screened. So it's somebody's making a judgment there. So that's there. Secondly, I think that when you talk about screening means screening is just a preliminary tool. That can be wrong. It can be wrong on the positive side. It can be wrong on the negative side. And it depends on the tool and the circumstances. So you know, A, you're not necessarily referring somebody or giving the name of somebody who actually has a mental illness. But even if they did have an actual mental illness, my point remains that they're not being asked. And staff looked up for me the, what Section 13.46 actually says, the definition of county welfare, of the welfare system. And it includes county welfare agencies, local social services, human services boards, state hospitals, state nursing homes, ombudsman for mental health. And then any if they're under contract with any of those, it could be other agencies, institutions, and organizations would all be included in that term. So it's a very broad term. I mean, again, I'm not against that, you know, what you're trying to do here. The idea of offering services to people, to finding people, you're already screening people in jails, which is great. You know, everybody probably ought to be screened, hopefully with their consent, you know, but maybe at times not. But, you know, then to just hand over their name without even asking them, without asking them are they under somebody else's care already, you know, is this something they're interested in? I just... you know, think is really, really too broad. The other thing I just wanted to mention is the comment that, oh, NAMI likes it. Well, it's been through this and it's been through that. You know, okay, yeah, sure. It's good to know who who's for a bill, who's against a bill. It helps all orient us. We deal with a ton of stuff around here, and we can't possibly drill down into every single thing. On the other hand, I hope that members kind of will resist the notion that because somebody else thinks it's okay that they shouldn't apply their own independent reasoning. I think our strength as a, you know, our strength and the reason we have all these people around the table and that we do this process is so that hopefully, you know, somebody will notice something about a bill as it flows through. And so, you know, please, members, don't check your independence at the door for anybody, whether it's your caucus or an organization that you like or, you know, and we all do it. I'm not criticizing anybody for that. We all do that at times because we simply have to decide who we trust and trust them. But, you know, I'm raising an issue here that I think is a serious issue, and I just hope members will think about this seriously, because any of us or our children or our family could be in this situation. And do you want, because somebody either screened positive for some mental illness or, you know, somebody thinks you have a mental illness, is now going to give your name to any of these things on the list that's under 13.46. It just needs tightening is all I'm saying. Representative Zerwas, you're usually so willing to work on stuff. I mean, I just would like to hear you say, yes, I'll think about this, I'll work on it, I'll tighten it up, because there's a little issue here. That's all.
Representative Zerwas, she told you what you need to say.
Well, I guess there's an easy way and there's a hard way. We'll see how this goes. Mr. Chair, members, on line 1.15, the or may have a mental illness is for people that self-report when they go to jail that they have a mental illness. And if you look at lines 1.15 to 1.16, it says names of persons who have screened positive or may have a mental illness may be shared with the local county service agency. The jail may refer an offender to county personnel of the welfare system as defined in order to arrange for services upon discharge. So then the names may be shared with the local county services. That's in the bill. And from there, if there needs to be coordination with the broader welfare system, then if you look down from line 1.20 and 2.1 through 2.7, that's the coordination that they can provide in conjunction with people in the broader welfare system. Representative Leland, as always, I will continue to work on this bill as it may be able to be improved, and if you and I can find some compromise language, I don't think we're going to be taking up bills off the general register anytime soon. I think those are going to wait a while. So I can continue to work with you if there's some amendment language that we can find agreeable.
Representative Lublin?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Zerwas. I think that you skipped a really important part of this when you read it, and that is, and may share private data as necessary. So, but I appreciate where you're at, and that's, you know, thank you.
Representative Sandstead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Zerwas, I understand the intent of this bill, and I appreciate it very much, what you're trying to get at. I have a couple of different questions for you, one being, are there other states that are currently doing this?
Representative Zerwas. Or Ms. Radke.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I am not aware of other states that are doing this, but can certainly do some research and report back.
Representative Sandstead.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I have another question regarding when notification would take place to the county agency. Would it take place earlier on in the intake process, or is it done upon release of an inmate?
Ms. Radke.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the actual notification to the county social services would really be dependent on what is happening, I think, with that individual. You know, when that intake process is happening, one thing that we know in working and coordinating with our jails is that intake process can, depending on circumstances, can be kind of a chaotic process. And so there's a lot of dependency there as to when that actual notification would happen. We are talking from an operational standpoint. Could there be some sort of consistent, just a reporting at a point in time that makes sense that, you know, would alert the local mental health authority? And again, just to clarify what Representative Zerwas shared, that limited sharing of that positive screen would not be with the broader welfare agency, but would be just limited to the county social services mental health authority. But we are talking about just some initial reporting that could happen.
Representative Sandstead.
Mr. Chair, currently is there any type of a screening or an outtake process when a person is leaving a facility?
Ms. Radke.
There is some, when someone is leaving, Mr. Chair, Representative, when a person is leaving jail, and again, I think these processes really vary with how long a person is actually in a county jail. If it's very short term, there may not be, there typically isn't a more formal discharge plan. When someone is incarcerated for a longer period of time, jails typically do a more formal discharge plan. And so to the and the second part of the language, too, as the jail is considering referrals to the broader welfare system, typically that would happen as part of a more intensive, like, discharge plan.
Representative
Sandstead. Mr. Chair, I guess I'm wondering, the state of an individual oftentimes in the intake process can look very different than when they leave. Mm-hmm. And the triggering of this report, I wonder, I guess I'm just wondering if it might be effective or beneficial to have an outtake screening. What you see at the end of their stay may not warrant notification, or those two screenings may look very different and potentially may not warrant notifying. And then I guess the last question I would have for you is just wondering, should a county agency be notified of an individual? How long do they hold on to that record? And what do they do with that record?
Ms. Radke.
Mr. Chair, Representative, right now, I mean, any records that would come over are subject to all of the data retention schedules, as well as all of the other data privacy statutes that would apply to those records. The intent would be when we get that information back and that report from the local corrections office, would be to just make an assessment of what is happening with these individuals, working with the jails as necessary. And we may find, I think to your comments of, you know, a person's situation leaving jail and upon further information may not warrant any action on our part. I mean, so the fact that we have that information may not result in, you know, if they're receiving the appropriate treatment. I mean, they may even be known within the county social services, may already be receiving services, but it's a good for us to know if someone's interfacing with the correction system. But that assessment of what will happen next is really to, I think the representative who is no here, what that person really needs. I mean, the goal is to provide those person-centered, coordinated services early on. So what will actually happen is really dependent on that individual.
Representative Sanchez. Thank you. Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify on House File 1331? Seeing none, any final questions from members? Final word, Representative Zerwas.
Thank you, members, for the brief discussion.
With that, I'll renew my motion that House File 1331 be referred to the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed, same sign?
No.
The motion prevails and House File 1331 is referred to the General Register. Thank you, Representative Zerwas.
Thank you.
Next up, House File 1938, Representative Baker. Representative Baker moves that House File 1938 be referred to the Committee on Health and Human Service Finance. We have the bill in front of us, Representative Baker, when you are ready to your bill.
Mr. Chair, members, also we have a DE amendment that we'd like to introduce as well, which really slims it down quite a bit, and we'll kind of cover that if we could.
Representative Baker moves the DE-1 amendment. Are there any questions to the DE-1 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The DE-1 amendment is adopted. Representative Baker, to your bill as amended.
Mr. Chair, members, I just wanted to explain a little bit about some of the technical changes we made to the DE-1. It really just moves the Rule 25. It deletes the language from moving Rule 25 from rule into statute. Also, it moves Rule 31 from rule into statute. Just because of time this year and this meeting to go to civil law, we wanted to make sure that we get the right part of this bill that's still very supported by the chemical treatment facilities and what we're trying to do with this bill and the intention. So we wanted to make sure that was part of this. So, Mr. Chair, members, substance use disorder is the waiver we're looking for to make sure that we can provide better service for folks needing treatment. Minnesota has been a national leader in many ways with the substance use disorder. I'm going to use it as SUD treatment. However, we know the feedback from providers in the community that we need to have some improvements. Some of the things we're really seeing is long waits to get into treatment has been a real issue. Timeliness and getting access to comprehensive assessments followed by receiving the right services can literally mean the difference of life and death. We also need to provide a wider range of services for folks that are needing this kind of help. We need to reach more people with the right kind of help at that time. And we also need to reach people earlier. We must reach these people before they need the intensive care level. DHS has been leading a multi-year process to reform our SUD treatment system. In 2017, the SUD reform recommendations started with a legislative mandate back in 2012. Leading to community input from across the state, and finally to providers and the community coming to the table to work together to find solutions. The result is a set of policy recommendations designed to not only improve outcomes, but also to ensure program sustainability and invest our scarce resources wisely. These changes will draw federal Medicaid funding, primarily by using existing state funds, and we'll start treating the disease as one that needs ongoing support after treatment to improve the client's success. Some of the recommendations including the following. Direct access comprehensive assessment. In order to decrease the wait time between seeking treatment and getting it, Minnesota needs to allow individuals to go directly to a provider to be assessed for a Rule 25 assessment. A credentialed professional will determine intensity and duration of treatment facilities. Withdrawal management, otherwise kind of known as detox. Adding withdrawal management services to the state's Medicaid benefit set in order to expand the continuum of this care is very important. Withdrawal management services include treatment, care coordination, and peer support services. And then care coordination. Add care coordination as a reimbursement treatment service. Care coordination is services provided by individuals credentialed to provide chemical dependency treatment services outside of the regular treatment system. This would both increase access to services early and provide a more appropriate level of care for many. And then direct reimbursement. This adds appropriately credentialed individuals as eligible vendors of the SUD treatment services in setting such as in schools, primary care, and jails. And also peer support. Making peer support reimbursable to both provide a needed service and to help address the need for more workforce. DHS will identify vendors equipped to provide appropriate supervision of these services and the individuals providing that service. The legislation reiterates that DHS will seek a federal waiver that will further improve SUD services and seek flexibility in the IMD law. IMD stands for Institute of Mental Disease. Numerous treatment facilities in our state have been designated as IMDs, with more expected next year. This means that treatment provided in these facilities, because they are 16 beds or larger, cannot receive federal funding. That is a major issue for us. I am excited to be carrying this legislation, and I know that there has been a tremendous amount of work that has gone into these priorities. There's a letter of support as well, members from the counties, that really support this change and this reform, and I appreciate your support. And Mr. Chair, with me today I have Lane Emmer to talk about this a little bit further.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Emmer. If you could please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Well, Mr. Chair, members, good morning. My name is Lane Elmer. I'm the CEO of New Beginnings Minnesota. We are a treatment organization serving rural communities throughout Minnesota. I'm also on the board of MARCH, which has over 60 agency members like New Beginnings, as well as 2,000 professionals that are working in the daily trenches of addiction care. So on behalf of MARCH, I am very excited to support this bill and support this reform package as it is much needed for Minnesota. And I'd like to personally thank Assistant Commissioner Claire Wilson and her team, who've worked very hard with many stakeholders over the last year to bring this bill as it is situated today. So our field has long recognized the need for transition of our treatment delivery system from a episodic model to a more fluid and longitudinal form of care in order to better and more effectively manage the illness of addiction. So, for example, clients that we see out at Waverly in our residential program do really, really well while they're in treatment. Now, upon discharge, sometimes that's when they get into trouble because they don't have the support, they don't have somebody to talk to, and they'll often, times are too often, relapse and not maintain the recovery. So there are items of this reform, like the additions of low-cost peer support and care coordination, which are going to be a significant improvement to prevent clients from falling through the cracks, and it's going to help them maintain their long-term recovery. This is going to lower the overall relapse rate, reduce the number of readmissions to residential programs like New Beginnings. It's going to save the state some money, and it's going to improve the lives of those suffering from addiction. Like Representative Baker said, this is also a critical component to the 1115 waiver. As far as I know, if DHS submits the application for the 1115 and these important reforms don't go through, it's going to be dead upon arrival. So to clean up this IMD exclusion mess, this reform is critical to get the 1115 waiver. So in closing, our field's been waiting for reform for a long time. We're basically operating under the same system that was created in the 1980s. A lot has changed since the 1980s. Science, best practices, federal regulation, state regulation, and cost. We've been working on this for about 5 years with DHS, with many stakeholders, to bring forward many of these important reforms to move to a more longitudinal form of care. One key piece that was missing in this original legislation was the rate increase, which we are very grateful for Representative Baker's leadership on House File 872, because we really feel like the two fit very nicely together. Because as many members have heard me say before, without some modest increases over the next few years, many programs are going to have difficulty keeping their doors open. So we want to keep our doors open. We want to keep our head above water, so that we can work with DHS and the state to implement these important reforms. So We thank you for your support and your time, and I'm happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Thank you, Mr. Elmer, for your testimony this morning. Are there any questions for the testifier? Representative Lublin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you. This is really good. I'm glad to see this, and I'm glad that so many people have been working on this. This is good. I probably missed this in the beginning when we went from this thing to this thing. And I just, now that I'm kind of oriented to what we're talking about, I wonder if you could just maybe, Representative Baker, just tell us again briefly, you know, what are we leaving out that was in the big form?
Representative Baker.
You know, members, what I would prefer to do is having Assistant Commissioner Wilson come down. She is good at this, explaining this, and I don't want to waste our time, me rambling through something. So if I could ask Ms. Wilson to come down, too. I think, obviously, there's a lot of changes. It went from a four-pound bill to a two-ounce bill. But it's still very important that we get this part of it through it this year now. And again, we've been spending a lot of time in the last 24 hours trying to get our arms around this. So thank you for the question.
Welcome to the committee, Commissioner Wilson. If you could please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
I'm Claire Wilson, Assistant Commissioner with the Department of Human Services. And Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, what reduced this bill from 120 million pages to this brief in front of you is just simply that the initial bill was moving Rule 31 from rule into statute. And so that required a lot of language changes. And after listening to some concerns from providers about that, as well as realizing that it was going to require a little bit of a bigger lift legislatively, we preserved the core pieces of the bill, which are essential for moving the reform and allowing us to apply for the 1115 waiver. So what you have in front of you are the core pieces of the reform that are necessary to move forward.
Representative Liebling.
Okay, yeah. Thank you very much for that explanation. Appreciate it.
Are there any other questions for the testifiers? Seeing none, is there anyone else who wishes to testify on House File 1938? Seeing none, final questions for the bill author? Final word, Representative Baker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. This is a very important legislation that I think is really going to bring some much better holistic care to folks that are just entering treatment, getting through it, and also to help them along their journey afterwards as well. So thank you so much for your support.
With that, Representative Baker renews his motion on House File 1938 as amended. Be referred to the Committee on Health and Human Service Finance. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The motion prevails and House File 1938 as amended is referred to the Committee on Health and Human Service Finance. Thank you, Representative Baker. Next up today, members, we have House File 1245. I will move House File 1245 be referred to the General Register. And this is the Department's policy bill for the year. And as they make their way to settle in, we do have the A1 amendment and we have a couple oral amendments that will help to get the bill in the order in which we would like to present it. Welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Certainly. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, my name is Jennifer Sommerfeld. I am the Legislative Director for Children and Family Services. I will talk to you about part of the amendment today and the first article of the bill.
All right. Please present your testimony.
Mr. Chair, would you like me to cover the oral amendment first?
Yes. We'll go through all the parts and then adopt the amendments at the end.
At the end. Okay. So Article 1 of our bill that is here today largely refers to statutes governing child safety and permanency, and most of what is in the bill right now, actually, they're technical changes. The majority of them are. On your background sheets on page 1, I'm going to go through the background sheets, a number of sections, 1, 3, 7, 8, 9, 10, and 11 of the bill simply clean up the language, eliminate cross-references and program names that are no longer correct. Some of them are outdated. There were some grammatical errors, that type of thing. Also on page 1, it's a proposal called Providing Consistency in Definitions. That's in sections 2, 4, and 5 of your bill. This is another technical amendment. It makes shared terminology consistent across foster care and permanency sections of the statute. It also clarifies eligibility for North Star Care Assistance to avoid that to ensure that court orders will properly use the statutes governing granting of joint physical and joint legal custody. Right now, some courts will grant that with parents, which is a reunification process, not a permanency process, and doing so makes people ineligible for North Star. So we're clarifying that when you are working on a permanency placement, that transfer from the legal and physical custody does not end up shared with a parent. On page 2 of your background sheets, we have a proposal in section 6 of the bill. This eliminates confusion and conforms to federal law by clarifying that relative custodians who are currently receiving North Star kinship assistance are eligible to receive North Star adoption assistance on behalf of the child that they're seeking to adopt. Section 12 of the bill, also on page 2 of the background sheets, we have a proposal that will clarify the appeals process for North Star adoption and kinship assistance. Right now, the way the statute is written, it creates problems for the human services judges. They see examples in there of extenuating circumstances and believe that that is the only way that they can find that, which is not the case. So we've eliminated some redundancies and taken out those examples simply to make the statute a little more clear. And that is what is in the bill.
For Article 1.
For Article 1, yeah. But I have new things that will be in Article 1 for the amendment, but I will wait on that.
All right. Are there any questions on Article 1 as it was presented? Seeing none, thank you, Ms. Sommerfeld. Welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record and present your article.
Okay. Good morning. My name is Carol Levine, and I'm the Deputy Director for Mental Health at DHS, and I'm going to talk about Article 2. This article has three main sections, which includes changing standards for certified peers, family peer specialists, and mental health behavioral aides, a cleanup for mobile crisis response services, and a technical correction project. The majority of this section is around improving the standards for mobile crisis, and these are in sections 1 through 14, 17, 20 through 29, and 32 to 39. Mobile crisis services are here to assist children, families, and adults who are experiencing a mental health crisis to cope with that crisis. And under this service model, a mental health crisis responder assesses the crisis, assists the person in coping with the crisis, and then follows up with the person that he or she receives longer services and supports as needed. In 2015, we had a large investment by the legislature into our mobile crisis services, and as part of that, we had a goal to go 24/7 in all 87 counties by 2018, and we are on track for that. We were also directed in the legislature to update the standards, and that's what we're doing today. We do recognize that if the response is uneven or unpredictable across the state, people may not get their needs met, and they may cease in actually even using the service. Crisis services require a provider to meet a client in a stressful situation, so proper training and support is absolutely critical to the service. And this is especially true when meeting the needs of people who may be outside of that provider's legal specialty. So we have heard and received lots of feedback around improving the training-specific direction in the statute for children, elders, and underserved communities. We've also had two separate set of standards in mobile crisis teams serving children and those adults, and that's why you see a lot of changes. So we've gone from having mobile crisis services in four different statutes to two. We have an Adult Mental Health Act and a Children's Mental Health Act, and then we had two Medicaid sections, one for adult and one for children. And what we've done is we now have one section in the Mental Health Act for mobile crisis services, and then we reference over to the Medicaid standards. This is necessary because we have grants and other providers that pay for this service, and by having it in the Medicaid only, this was causing a lot of confusion and limiting access. So this proposal seeks to improve the quality and consistency of our mental health crisis services. And that's by providing more consistent and robust definitions. So to address this issue, we'll simply simplify and unify the standards, as I explained, for both children and adults, and implement clarified standards around training. We create standardized criteria for teams in determining the need to send out and do dispatch for immediate mobile response. It supports better integration of mobile crisis teams in hospital emergency departments. It ensures that these services are delivered consistently throughout the state while retaining the flexibility to meet unique regional needs and accounting for the differences in working with children and adults. And we also ensure that individuals, family members, and other emergency responders can rely on mobile crisis as a dependable, credible service. The next section I'll speak to is regarding mental health provider service standards qualifications, and this is sections 15, 16, 30, and 31. This deals with certified updating language and training requirements around certified peer specialists, family peer specialists, and mental health behavioral aides. Certified peer specialists are individuals with a lived experience who have gone through extensive training and can provide a certified peer specialist service as part of other service standards. And then family peer specialists are family members with a lived experience who have also gone through training. So within the current statute, we talk about certifying more programs, and actually what we're certifying are issues. We're cleaning up the language so that it reflects that we're certifying not programs but individuals. The current language also uses the term counseling, which is not really a service that a certified peer or family peer can even provide. And this is also following recommendations that we've received around a certified peer specialist. The mental health behavioral aid also is addressed in this section, and this is also to clarify training topics that in order to better create the curriculum and better train the mental health behavioral aids. This is a service that is for children within the children's system only. And the last piece I'll speak to is around a technical cleanup within our assertive community treatment or ACT policy, and this is in sections 18 and 19. And this section is, as I said, a technical cleanup. Last year, the legislature passed the standard cleanup for assertive community treatment, and within that, inadvertently, we did leave out one of the key positions, which is the lead mental health professional. So this language puts that into the statute and aligns it with the expectations of DHS and the evidence-based practice that is ACT.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Levine, for your testimony on Article 2. Are there any questions about Article 2? Seeing none, the committee thanks you. Welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record and present your portion of the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, Reggie Wagner with DHS, and I'll be covering sections 1 through 30 of Article 3. These sections impact and change some of the statutes related to the licensing work and some of the oversight and program integrity issues from our Fraud and Financial Abuse Division. Section 1, as always, we are looking to both make sure that we're always in conformity with any federal requirements, as well as identifying new gaps in some of our documentation or oversight requirements. Section 1 provides an additional tool to ensure that providers who are excluded from one DHS program are not able to maintain any current enrollment that they already have. I mean, we're trying to sort of look broadly and realize that we have providers that are interacting with us in licensed and unlicensed services, and if we take an action in one area, we want to be certain that we are being consistent in applying some of that exclusion from programs across all of our program areas. Sections 2 through 16 address issues related to licensing, definitions of owner and controlling individual, and also creates a statutory framework for the sale of a currently licensed program when the buyer intends to apply for a license and take over that program. Currently in statute, a license issued by the Department of Human Services is not transferable. Oftentimes, transactions don't understand that. The individuals don't realize that, and they think that when they do the close on the business and purchase the inventory, the building, and so forth, that they automatically get the DHS license as part of that, and that's not the case. And so we have tried to really take the issues that have come up on a transactional level and try to be really clear. What is it that DHS needs to know If you're currently licensed and you're buying a program from a different provider who maybe is getting out of the business, retiring, not in that area, we know the most about you as a license holder, and so how can we streamline some procedures around that? So the ownership provisions tries to both clarify who is an owner, what types of changes does the department need to know about, when would a change just be something we update in our licensing database, and when is it a change that actually would require a new license. And so what we have found is that there's no real clarity in our statute, and we have tried to both look at, over the last, say, 5 years, a lot of the issues that have come up, and try to say very clearly, this is the type of thing that does need to be reported, this will trigger a new license, and we think that that will be very beneficial for the providers around that. The sections 13 and 17 slightly different, but again, help us to, we hope, be more streamlined and efficient with our providers. They create what is called a provisional license. And I just want to make clear that both the changes that I've just talked about and this really are not designed to impact what we would call our family systems program, family child care, family adult foster care. We have a delegated licensing system where the county does much of that work when the license holder lives on site, on the premises. And so we are trying to not make changes in anything that would happen for those providers and allow that licensing scheme to continue as is. These are more for what we call our directly licensed. They would be chemical dependency treatment centers. They would be child care centers, community residential settings, and group homes. So we're trying to ensure that, you know, generally the smaller individuals who have that relationship at the county level and do the licensing work there are not impacted by that. The provisional license, generally right now, as we are working with applicants, we either can approve or deny a license, and we really don't have a middle ground. We provide a great deal of technical assistance as part of the application process, but we often do see a license holder applicant who is struggling to understand the rules, struggling to understand, you know, how they have to create a particular policy. And even though we're giving some technical assistance, it may take quite a while for them to come and get us the document in the right way or to understand the need to consult with somebody. There's a few places in childcare where they have to have like a healthcare consultant. We are trying to design a provisional license so that it gives us the ability to say yes, but, and we think that the but allows us to identify. These are places where we've seen you struggling. It doesn't materially and immediately impact the health and safety. Otherwise, we should be saying no. We should not be granting that license. But we are trying to put with this, some license holders on notice that these are the areas that we've seen you struggling. We are required under current statute to go out in the first 12 months and do an inspection and to see that program in operation in the first 12 months. What we're trying to operationalize is the feedback at that time to ensure that if the areas that we noted for them, we saw them struggling with, we're looking for that and any other general compliance, that we, at the end of that 15-month period of a provisional license, we would be having them do a very streamlined application for permanent license, but it would allow us to maybe more quickly identify license holders who clearly are not complying. We see many license holders ending up on conditionals within 24 months as a new license holder because they just haven't been able to successfully operationalize compliance. And so we're trying to kind of front load a little bit more of the technical assistance and create a provisional license. All of that would have a due process for the individual. If we were to deny their request to move from a provisional to a permanent license, we have all of the due process and hearing rights that are already built into our statute that would be triggered. There's a few places in those provisions that we have been working with stakeholders by and large. The feedback we've gotten is that this really does streamline and operationalize some of the issues that license holders have worked with us on, particularly on the sale of businesses. And there are a few places both in the amendment and places that we're continuing to work where we're refining some of the language with some feedback from stakeholders. Sections 21 through 30, you know, move more to some enhanced requirements and documentation requirements in particular for in-home services, both under our home and community-based waiver program, as well as our PCA, personal care assistance program. And what we see is some potential gaps in some oversight requirements in federal law, and also some need to clarify things. Currently, a service recipient who's receiving personal care assistance, if we are taking an action against the provider to stop payments because of a overpayment or an actual fraud issue where we would limit the billing and cut off the funding to the provider, we don't have any authority to notify the service recipient that the program they're getting services from is not going to have the money coming in, which would impact paying the workers. And we're trying to operationalize a more efficient way so that the department, from its various areas and also working with the county, can provide appropriate notice to clients that there is going to be a payment withhold happening, and to work to transition clients to new and additional service providers and to ensure that they do not have an interruption. So that is an important piece of what we would have here. Some of the other provisions in sections 21 through 30 would establish service documentation and billing requirements for home and community-based providers, and we're trying to get very clear about the type of notes and details that we need to be able to have a clear paper trail and ensure that the person who is listed for the billing, that we can document, you know, what time of day they were there. We can often compare that with other records from other businesses or employment that they may have, and so the precision on the time cards allows us to more clearly say who might have appropriately been working at two jobs on one day and who may have been working at a job and billing for something that wasn't being delivered. So that's the type of precision that we're trying to bring in. We're requiring the qualified professionals, which are a specific staffing under the personal care assistance program, to have clear documentation and to link the payment of PCA services to the qualified professional actually going out as required under statute and providing those services. There's specific timelines at which a qualified professional needs to be interacting and visiting the client, especially during the first year of service, and so we want to enhance the need to be sure that those visits are happening, that they're being documented, and tying that to payment if there is a real clear problem that the qualified professional is not being out there. We are adding some documentation requirements consistent with transportation services, a greater ability to oversee and ensure program integrity in paid provider travel. We are requiring that any healthcare provider convicted of a program related crime could be excluded from participation as a provider for up to 5 years from the date of the conviction. And this is trying to be consistent with what some federal law is. So that are the main things that are in sections 21 through 30. We have worked with some stakeholders on some language in the amendment to address some concerns, to get some clarity, and to perhaps maybe not have what might have been perceived as some duplicative reporting requirements that might already exist in statute, and where our attempt to be a little bit more precise seemed to either be redundant or inconsistent. So we know that some of that language would be in the amendment that you'll hear more about.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Wagner, for your walkthrough of Article Sections 1 through 30. Are there any questions about that portion of the bill? All right. The committee thanks you for your testimony on that portion. Thank you. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Chair and members, my name is Christopher Oren, the Legislative Director for Operations for DHS. The final sections of Article 3, 31 through 34, clarify administrative processes for counties in financial dispute procedures. Items such as how a child county of residency is determined for purposes of determining financial responsibility, which provisions apply to social services and which apply to financial services, what processes should be allowed by should be followed by each county that are a part of an appeal of that nature. These are in response to questions that we have received from counties on these types of issues, as they're not frequent cases that come up. So hopefully to clarify that part of statute. Additionally, the sections clarify that interpreters of translation services must be provided by the agency who took the action under appeal. And those are those final sections.
All right. Any questions from members on Article 3, Sections 31 through 34? Seeing none, committee thanks you. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Mr. Chair, members, Matt Burdick. I'm the Legislative Director for the Healthcare Administration at the Department of Human Services. I will walk briefly through Article 4. Article 4 has three sections. Section 1 deals with our state medical review team, also known as SMRT. The SMRT team is responsible for making assessments to determine if someone is eligible for medical assistance based on a disability. And the way this process works is someone would receive a referral from their county or tribal agency, and they would then submit information to the state. In 2014, we worked with the local agencies to streamline this process so that DHS could get the medical record portion of the client's records directly from the healthcare provider so that counties or tribes weren't in the position to have to collect that information, know what was relevant, what wasn't, which created sort of a cumbersome and time-consuming process for all involved. So this change here simply clarifies what the role of the local agency is when making that referral to the SMRT team for that review. Sections 2 and 3 relate to provider enrollment for personal care assistance providers. Section 2 simply clarifies our existing expectation that providers have all the requisite training prior to submitting an application. The purpose for this is so that providers aren't submitting applications that are then rejected, then having to reapply, so that saves time both in the provider and for us at DHS. And then Section 3 simply clarifies that PCA providers that are terminated from enrollment simply because they failed to complete their revalidation in a complete and timely fashion aren't excluded from re-enrolling for 2 years. This is the same as it works for all other providers, so that if you are disenrolled due to what's up being a clerical error, technical error, that you're not excluded from the program for an extended period of time. And that is what's in Article 4.
All right. Questions for Mr. Burdick on Article 4? Seeing none, the committee thanks you for your testimony on Article 4. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and present your testimony.
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Alex Bartolik, and I'm with the Disability Services Division, and I'm here to talk about Section 5. It starts on the bottom of page 8 if you're looking at your background sheet. Much of this article deals with the policy implementation of a home and community-based services rule that was implemented and issued by the federal government by the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. And as home and community-based services have grown across the country, there was criticism about whether or not we were being consistent across the country and whether or not we were achieving the outcomes that the services were intended to receive. So CMS, the federal government, issued this rule in large part to assure that we are making these programs really work for people, that we're honoring their rights, we're giving choices, and we're assuring that they are truly home and community-based services. The rule itself contains different portions. It talks about having conflict-free case management. It talks about what's meant by the word person-centered planning, and it also talks about the characteristics of the settings and services themselves, and that's the portion of the rule that this article deals with. The rule was promulgated and issued in March of 2014. We have 5 years to come into compliance. We have worked extensively with stakeholders to identify where we need statutory changes to clarify the policy in statute as part of our compliance with the rule. Now, we've put everything that we're going to be doing in a plan to CMS. They have to approve our transition plan and agree that the changes that we're making to our program are in compliance with the rule. We haven't heard back yet, but we are reasonably sure that we will be given an interim approval where they will say, this makes sense, but we will want to be able to monitor and assure that all these things you said you were going to do actually occurred. Some of the assurances that are in the policy statements have to do with primarily residential programs as well as overall what providers need to do to make sure that rights are protected. So, for example, it has assurances to make sure that people have access to food and water at any time where they're living, that there is a right to furnish their own room and have visitors and have a choice if there's going to be a roommate, and also primarily that they're really working on being engaged in the community with people who don't have disabilities and that the services don't isolate people. So that is much of the article, but then there are a few other sections. At the bottom of page 9, section 3 is giving the DHS greater authority to manage corporate foster care capacity. This is when a license holder doesn't live in the home. It's different than family foster care. And they're hiring staff to come in. Sometimes they're referred to as group homes. And we have a moratorium, so we have a certain number that we can have in the state. And as we do needs determination and gaps analysis, we know that there are certain parts of the state that really don't have the services that are needed in their location. And there's other parts of the state that have quite a bit. And we don't want people to have to move 200 miles away from family and friends to access a service. So this is giving DHS the authority to be able to align the capacity where it's needed in the state and for the types of specialized services that are most needed. On the bottom of page 10, or on page 10, there is a section in sections 8, 20 through 24. It updates statute to add a new service, individualized home supports. We have learned, as providers have been doing a lot of creative ways of trying to support people, of dealing with the staffing crisis, and really trying to honor people's choices to live more independently, we have learned that we have some gaps in our services, and this service is intended to fill one of those gaps. It would be added to the disability waivers, which are the waivers for people with developmental disabilities, brain injury, people who are at risk of nursing home care, as well as hospital level of care. And it really supports people to live in their own home. And an example of this might be where a provider is supporting four or five people in an apartment building that might have 25 or 30 people living there, and it allows for intermittent services. It allows for the use of technology where that can appropriately be supporting people so we can reduce the intensity of staff and get the right service at the right time. So this statute is adding this service into the licensing standards and the rate setting standard. It is a cost neutral provision. It's only policy because without this service, people are using more expensive services and more intensive services. We want to give them a bridge to living more independently. The bottom of page 10 and section 12, we have alternatives to 245D licensing, training requirements in the license. Right now, the license requires a certain number of hours of training. And what we find is as workers may move from one provider to another, those workers end up doing the same number of hours again. So we also find that some people who have gone through the hours of training aren't necessarily competent in what we want to do. This is allowing an option for providers to use a competency-based training in order to really assure that people are competent, and then that competency follows the worker even if they move to another provider. We think it will get closer to what we're intending to do with the training requirements and give some more flexibility. There are curriculum out there that are competency-based. In fact, the legislature has approved funding to make one available. It's through a College of Direct Supports. Much of the training can be online, so people can take it at a time that's convenient. But there's also a performance management component of it for the supervisors and managers of the provider to be able to observe and find out, is the person actually exhibiting the competences that we want to see with that? On page 11, section 16 and 25 change some of the notices requirements for PCA and Community First Services and Supports. And it extends the notice of time that a provider would give before terminating services from 10 days to 30 days. And what we are finding, particularly as we have a workforce shortage, that if a provider wants to terminate services, it's very difficult to actually get set up with a new provider and assure that somebody is lined up to deliver those services within the 10 days. So allowing 30 days gives the person more time to get set up with the provider so there's not a break in services. That is it for Section 5, and I'll just mention, Article 5. Article 6 are technical amendments that were discussed with the reviser that just makes the bill cleaner. So there is no policy change in that. They are all technical.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Bartolik, for your walkthrough of Articles 5 and 6. Are there any questions from members on Articles 5 and 6? Seeing none, the committee thanks you for your presentation of those articles. That wraps up the walkthrough of the initial bill. We do have a few amendments. Who's coming to help us walk through those amendments? Welcome back.
Thank you very much. Good morning. Again, my name is Jennifer Sommerfeld. I'm the Legislative Director for Children and Family Services. I believe there's an oral amendment. Would you like me to address that first or the A1?
If you would, please walk through the oral amendment first.
Certainly. We do have an oral amendment. The oral amendment simply deletes Article 3, Section 35, and Article 5, Section 10 of the bill.
Okay. If you could say those numbers again, Ms.
Certainly. Sommerfeld. Article 3, Section 35. And Article 5, Section 10.
All right, are there any... I will move the oral amendment that we strike Article 3, Section 35, and Article 5, Section 10. Are there any questions? Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Could you just remind us what those are? Are we on the bill or on the amendment? I'm sorry.
We are on the bill.
On the bill. Okay.
Ms. Sommerfeld.
Yes, I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. Representative, we are on the bill for those...
And to those articles.
I will have to have somebody else speak to the articles specifically.
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Christopher Orr, Legislative Director for Operations for DHS. Section 35 in Article 3 deals with data transfer from the Department of Revenue related to investigation eligibility determinations. The section would need to go through judiciary, so in conversation we've decided to pull that from the bill. And then Section 10 deals with some, would return, keep language at, as it is in statute, as we're still having some conversations with stakeholders related to the planning elements involved in these sections.
Okay, and members, section Article 3, Section 35 is found on page 101 of the bill. Article 5, Section 10 is found on page 121. Are there any other questions to the oral amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed, same sign. The oral amendment is adopted. Now I will move the A1 amendment. Ms. Sommerfeld, welcome back. To the A1 amendment.
Thank you again. Jennifer Sommerfeld from Children and Family Services. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the first part of the amendment is on page 11 of your background sheets. And on the amendment itself, it starts on line 1.3 and actually runs through line 9.1. And what this does is it allows counties to make SNAP employment and training programs optional for people who come in who are able-bodied adults without dependents. They can receive SNAP benefits for 3 months and then are not eligible again for 3 years unless they meet the work requirements in the law. That does not change. What this does allow us to do is focus on the needs of that particular group of people. Some of them are looking for jobs on their own and don't need our employment and training services, and some of them are suffering from long-term homelessness or mental health or chemical dependency issues, and it allows the county workers to work with those people to try to stabilize their lives a little bit, which might make them more able to attain employment and retain it long-term. It doesn't change the policies regarding the work requirements. It just means during that time they don't have to participate in our employment and training services. So that is the first part.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And where does it say that it's specifically 3 months? How is it guaranteed that it's limited just to that short period and not interpreted or generated into rulemaking for a longer period?
Certainly. Mr. Chair, Representative, I will bring down Deb Schlick if I answer this incorrectly, but my understanding is that is in federal law. So the federal law sets the requirement for 3 months, and so we are required to follow that. Most of federal statute is what governs SNAP. SNAP is a federal program. It's not a state statute creation. But the federal law allows us to have a mandatory or a voluntary program for the employment and training services.
Representative Quam. All right. You can proceed.
Thank you. The second portion of the amendment relates to reporting on TANF and work participation rates and the self-support index. This is on page 12 of your background sheets and starts on lines 9.2 through 11.7 on the actual amendment. In the statute right now, there are a number of requirements for what reports the department is to produce on TANF or participation rates, and MFIP, and we found that that list is not flexible. It's an old list. It doesn't necessarily relate to how the program operates right now. We've come back a number of times over the years to ask for changes. It doesn't include any data on the diversionary work program put in place in 2004. And the department would like the opportunity to simply work with the counties and the tribes to find which reports work most effectively for us for improving their performance data and create that list of reports and report as we need to so we can be a little more flexible in that. That's part of that portion of the amendment. The other part requires that we do some reporting on the self-support index, and this measures the percentage of MFIP and diversionary work program cases off-cash assistance, but working 30 hours a week or more on 1, 2, and 3-year intervals. So we would like to do some reporting on following up on those cases. That portion. The next portion of the amendment is also on page 12 of the background sheets, and this is from lines 11.9 to 12.12 of the amendment itself. This clarifies existing law regarding lump sum payments for asset determination and ABLE accounts. Existing law right now says that if you receive a lump sum payment, that is counted as income for the first 2 months. I believe that's correct. And then after that, it is counted as an asset towards your asset limit. And that's not in statute. When we created 256P, a new eligibility statute, a couple of years ago, and that simply didn't transfer into the statute. So that's more technical. The other change also in 256P adds ABLE accounts to an excluded body of accounts for asset determination. When the ABLE account statute, Chapter 256Q, was established, the intent was to allow people with disabilities to save money and not have them count toward their assets. And inadvertently, a reference to that was left out. And that's all that changes.
Great. Mr. Chair, Matt Burdick, I will walk through the remainder of the amendment. Lines 12.13 through 12.24 are technical cleanup changes related to the section of the bill you heard about earlier related to mobile crisis services. These are mostly grammatical corrections and other feedback we've received from stakeholders. Lines 12.26 through 15.8 are being imported into this bill from another bill that Representative Gruenhagen was carrying. This would eliminate the requirement to have a host county contract for two intensive services that serve adults with serious mental illnesses. One is Intensive Residential Treatment Services, or IRTS, and the other is Assertive Community Treatment, or ACT. And both of these services are either licensed or certified by DHS. They're both Medicaid benefits. And so what this proposal seeks to do is eliminate a step in the process for bringing these new services online and that requirement to have a host county contract. There's nothing that would prevent a county from contracting with a provider should they have a financial arrangement with that provider. And it also requires that as part of their application process, they seek input and a letter of support from their local agency so that there's clear collaboration with the local agencies. And this is something we've worked on in collaboration with the mental health provider community as well as the counties. Lines 15.17 through 18.8 are technical cleanup changes related to the updates to the assertive community treatment standards that were discussed. That was, again, cleanup from the 2016 DHS policy bill. And then finally, lines 18.9 through 19.21. These are related to the mental health provider standards related to mental health behavioral aids. This is language clarifying what training people need to have and when they need to have it for those particular service types. The balance of the amendment after that is cleanup related to some of the sections related to documentation, and those are based on the stakeholder conversations that were referenced in previous testimony.
All right, are there any questions to the A1 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of the A1 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye, opposed, same sign. The A1 amendment is adopted. Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify on House File 1245 as amended? Seeing none, are there any final questions from members on House File 1245 as amended? Seeing none, I'll renew my motion that House Bill 1245 as amended be referred to the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The motion prevails and House Bill 1245 as amended is be referred to the General Register. With that, members, we are adjourned.